The way Americans die in this country is a national disgrace. That's according to Dr. Ira Byock in his new book, The Best Care Possible, A Physician's Quest to Transform Care Through the End of Life. Dr. Byock is the keynote speaker at the annual dinner of the Center for Practical Bioethics on April 19, 2012. For more information, visit practicalbioethics.org. Practicalbioethics.org. Dr. Byock is the director of palliative medicine at the Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and he joins us now on the Bioethics Channel. Dr. Byock, you first wrote about how Americans die in 1998 with Dying Well, and you've continued to write and speak about it since. Was there any one particular situation or incident that prompted you to write this most recent book?
Hi, Laurel. Thanks for having me. You know, it's a constellation of things. It's my daily practice, frankly. I and our team at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center care for people who have serious life-threatening conditions. Their needs are complex. They're physical, emotional, social, and even spiritual. Their family's needs are complex. And frankly, what I see day in and day out is that despite really, really smart physicians, nurses, social workers, mid-level practitioners, I could go on and on, despite the best of intentions that everybody has, sometimes we inadvertently make people's lives harder. The health system that we work in, and I think what I mean by that is the national health system, is really a disease treatment system. And while I, for one, celebrate that, and I think it's great that we have really unprecedented power to treat disease and help people live longer, what I see inadvertently is that we've made dying a lot harder than it needs to be. And I think we can fix this. I actually think that the barriers to fixing it are that we actually don't have a sense of what's achievable even now. And we certainly don't have a sense of how truly responsive and genuinely quality-based and person-centered, family-oriented care could be in the quite relatively near future. I mean just a handful of years from now, if we actually had a vision of what's possible and worked together to change it.
I have to share a personal experience with you. My brother died a couple of years ago. He was only 52 years old, and the care that he received was generally good, and I really had no complaints about that, but I couldn't help but sense within the system, a big hospital, and I won't say where, that the process was more for the convenience of the hospital and its professionals. Mm-hmm. Than for the people who were receiving that care and the family members who are there to support my brother in this case. That's not an unusual story for you, I presume.
It's not an unusual story. And, you know, in one hand, I'm really being critical, I think quite legitimately so, about our health system and about the care people receive at some of the quote-unquote best medical centers and in some of the most renowned hospitals in the country. On the other hand, I want to make clear there really isn't ill intention here. Doctors and nurses really care on a personal level for their patients. We recoil at the thought of our patients doing poorly. We ache when they ache. And that's, you know, in our cynical society, that's kind of a secret that's shared within the profession or in nods to one another. It's acknowledged, but not widely spoken about. In fact, however, though we care well and though we have lots of clinical skills, the system is so focused on cure and prolonging life and so oblivious to the needs of the people living with disease that so often we inadvertently disserve people at the far edge of life. You know, look, we live in unprecedented times. People are living so much longer with diseases that used to kill us quickly, congestive heart failure with pulmonary edema, cancers. Now over half of cancers are cured, and many more that we can cure, people can live with for a long period of time, even diabetes, and I could go on and on. So many miracles have extended life. The problem is we have yet to make even one person immortal. And so what we're doing is people are living longer with higher burdens of disease. for most of the time, you know, living with chronic illness is still quite good, and many Americans now live for years, sometimes decades, with chronic illnesses. All great. But as the burden of illness increases, and since we're still mortal, it's ironic that people are actually sicker as they die now than ever before. And yet, our health system and our social service system just, you know, tacitly abandons them to kind of figure out how you complete a life these days. You know, if they, even at the far end of life, if they are acutely ill and want treatment for whatever it would be, the pneumonia or renal failure or liver failure or heart failure, then the system will give that at all costs, no questions asked. But just the help to live in place, to age and live even with frailty and be cared for in a way that truly attends to people's comfort and quality of life and allows them to die gently, boy, that's a lot harder to arrange even today.
So I get the sense that there's more suffering on one side of this equation and some moral stress on the other side when it comes to the medical professionals.
That's very true. And again, not as often recognized as it ought to be. Moral distress is almost, you know, universal in many ICUs in the country. In fact, the Critical Care Nurses Association has identified moral distress as the number one reason why experienced critical care nurses leave the field. And since critical care nurses are highly valued professionals, very hard to train and replace, you would think that we would all, if only for that reason, be really attending to making sure that there that care is being provided consistent with the values and preferences of every patient in the context of their family, in the context of their religious and ethnic beliefs, and is directed at providing achievable outcomes. Outcomes that actually, you know, we have the technology and science to deliver. Helping people live forever, frankly, unfortunately, is not an achievable outcome. And so at some point, despite our collective love of life, which I think really is the true north here, a reverence for life is true north. I think we're all pro-life, frankly. But as we seek to honor and extend and celebrate life, we have to help people to figure out how they can die well today in these unprecedented, really marvelous times in which we live.
Our colleagues here at the Center for Practical Bioethics, we've been reading your book, The Best Care Possible, and some of my colleagues have been telling me that this is your most self-revealing book, that there's almost an intimacy with the way you engage readers in your stories. Would you agree with that?
Well, I appreciate the compliment. I mean, I take that comment as a compliment because I'm trying to be as transparent as possible here. The vision in my mind's eye as I was writing this book was to have the reader invisibly sitting like a little bird on my shoulder, going through very busy days and difficult clinical encounters in the family meetings, in the conference rooms, but as well as hallway conversations with medical students and residents and fellows. I take readers with me into a class that I teach to third-year students as they come back together for 3 weeks after they've dispersed and begun their clinical rotations. And I ask the question, so what are doctors for? These are places where the average person is not going to find themselves. Those classroom conversations, those private hallway conversations that I have with students, and the obviously behind closed clinical doors or drawn hospital curtains in conversations with patients. But there's nothing embarrassing or shameful or wrong about sharing this. I do so in a way that does protect people's privacy or is done with full permission from the patients whose real names I use. But I do want it to be revealing, and I hope it's instructive. I hope it gives people a sense of both the complexities, the good and the bad, and the ugly about the current situation, but also about what's possible for their and their family's care and collectively for what I think could be a much brighter future.
You devote some pages in this book to cost at the end of life. At the Bioethics Center, we often say how much is too much and who decides. But in a lot of cases, you don't really know the answers to those questions until after the fact, in hindsight.
I think we're currently today in the enviable situation, in a sense, that we're already spending far more on the end of life than anybody thinks is warranted, or we're certainly not getting our value out of the investment we make. We spend twice the amount of money per capita on each person in the United States than the next closest developed country like Sweden or Switzerland. And we're simply not getting enough value out of that enormous public and personal expense. We actually have a situation where if we really just focus right now on giving the best care possible, which is frankly what everybody wants, that's the only thing we all agree on, and really define a way of providing what is right for you and your family at this point in the course of an illness, and then revisiting that from time to time, we actually will significantly reduce costs. We're not going to balance the budget on, you know, people's care at the end of life. It's not, I don't want to in any way over dramatize this benefit, but we don't have to spend more money to get this right. In fact, if we focus on getting it right for each patient and family, we'll find that we're actually spending less money. And there's really good evidence just from the work that we do in hospice and palliative care that concurrent palliative care with disease treatment does not cost more. It consistently costs somewhat less, sometimes in the range of 30%, sometimes only 15% less, but less. And the reason is that if you can provide care and give people confidence that they and their families' needs will be better met, they won't come back to the hospital at some point, or their time in the hospital will be shorter. And the area under the curve of hospital use during the last, let's say, 6 months of life is consistently less with palliative care, and including hospice involved, than without it. We don't have to force a choice. We don't have to tell people they can't get hospice or palliative care till they give up disease treatments. Turns out even both together actually significantly reliably diminishes costs.
Dr. Bioch, after all of these years of effort, we still seem to have a conflict and a tension between medical professionals and families and others when it comes to the end of life. What will have to happen for all of us to do a better job of caring for the seriously ill and dying?
You know, this is a situation where we're all in this together. I mean, I'm a physician, and that's my service to the community and to society. But you know, at the end of the day, I'm mortal too. I'm a husband and a father and a brother and a son and a son-in-law and we all struggle with these issues. And people of various political beliefs and religious beliefs struggle with these issues in their own way. Yes, we're a diverse population. Yes, we have differences and different roles, but we could come together to really identify what matters most. You know, we want the best treatments for disease in general. 99% of people want the best treatments for disease. They want to live as long and as well as possible. And when their time comes, most people would like to die gently and leave this life surrounded by people they know and love and who love them. Even if we just focus on those basic elements of care, we could come together. I think what pins us down currently is the so-called culture war, which I've actually come to believe, Laurel, it's a myth. Or it's a mirage. We all have such commonality of our human condition that dwarfs the differences. I mean, when you think about it, when a tornado hits, or an earthquake, or a landslide, or a flood, or any natural disaster, people put aside their differences reflexively, and they work together for the common good. Well, It seems to me that death is the natural disaster that awaits us all. And you would think that in this at least, we could come together and work to the common good to ensure medical excellence and nursing excellence from our health system and providers, but also to ask for and expect tenderness and love as we care for one another through the end of life. That much we can deliver. That much is not going to break anybody's bank. In fact, it would allow us to rehumanize an increasingly uncivil society and leave to our children and generations to come a base of a civilized, caring society in which to meet the next generation's challenges.
Dr. Ivor Byock is the Director of Palliative Medicine at the Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in Lebanon, New Hampshire. His new book is The Best Care Possible, A Physician's Quest to Transform Care Through the End of Life, available at Amazon.com. I'm Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.